This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Right to Life of Northeast Indiana, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Abigail Lorenzen, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Lorenzen.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is produced by Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne in cooperation with Indiana Right to Life as well as Right to Life of Northeast Indiana.
On September 3, 2019, Dr. Klopfer passed from this life while sitting on the steps of his home in Crete, Illinois. Now, let me say at the outset that we do not delight in the death of anyone, even a man who was responsible for performing thousands of abortions. Klopfer was a well-known abortionist, having performed approximately 50,000 procedures over four decades, mostly in Indiana. He was held to account before his death by authorities in Indiana when his three abortion facilities were closed and his medical license was suspended. A member of Dr. Klopfer's family, Mark, is our guest today, and I've gotten to know him over the past year, and we've become really good friends. Welcome, Mark, and thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Hi, Kathy.
I know that you are a man of faith. What else would you like our listeners to know about you?
Well, I very much pro-life, and I have some personal experience with it because my girlfriend had an abortion when I was 15 years old. I remember the feelings I had of helplessness and who do I talk to? I had parents who weren't supportive. It was right after Roe v. Wade was passed. And so I didn't understand. I kind of just didn't want anything to do with it. I could see my whole life changing. I feel like in the end, my girlfriend and I were both victims. What our society has allowed to be perpetrated on young, uninformed, scared people who feel they have no other choice.
Mark, I know that there are some who are very harsh with those who have an abortion decision in their past. I'm not one of them because I see it as people like you who have an abortion, made an abortion decision, who believe the lie that for a price, the abortionist can erase the life of a baby. It was, I think, presented as a do-over, no big deal. So my heart is filled with compassion for you.
I just wanted to run, hide my head in the sand. You know, this can't be real. What am I going to do? And in some ways, it was like, this is your problem. Very selfish. You know, did not really realize the effect that this would have on me even 40 years later. On a special life Sunday at one of the fellowships I was a part of, I was able to, during a very intimate part of the service where we were celebrating efforts that had been made by people in our congregation to bring this to light, I was able to stand before the congregation of people who love me and confess it and be able to be seen by other people and heard by other people, some who, you know, may have turned away, but overall, I was able to receive forgiveness from the body of Christ. It was very, very freeing. Satan was no longer able to keep stabbing me with this guilt of, you know, look what you've done. And also ability to grieve and think, what could this person have been like? I could have had a son or a daughter now that was 20 years old.
But isn't it amazing, Mark, how the Lord can take the broken pieces and put us back together again? And we're not lost. We're not ruined forever. When we find grace and forgiveness at the foot of the cross of the Lord Jesus Christ, regardless of what our sin is. So your story of redemption and forgiveness, I'm certain will touch the hearts of many who are listening today.
Well, without the grace of God, I don't know where I'd go with, you know, all the feelings and all the unknown. It did set me up for when I found out there was actually strong people in, you know, a fellowship that I joined in my 20s, a congregation I was part of, and began a life center or a pregnancy resource center in where I live. And my wife became a part of the sidewalk counseling.
Wow.
And this was early on in the 80s when a lot of this was really new.
Right.
You know, a lot of the resistance and being constructive about it was really new. And the resources were starting to be provided to women who had to make hard choices to be able to be free to make the right choice. And it became painfully obvious to me that this is something not only to just take a side on, but something that you had to work toward getting justice for.
Absolutely. Well, what a remarkable story, and it certainly sets the stage for the rest of our conversation. Mark, would you be willing to tell us just how you're related to Dr. Klopfer?
He was married to my wife's sister. I didn't really have much of a, I would say, good relationship with him.
About how many years did you know him?
38 years. It began at his wife, my sister-in-law's, graduation from medical assisting school, and she did an internship at one of the first places he worked at in Illinois. And so there was a party that we had for the graduation, and he was there with quite a few of the staff, some of the other nurses and medical assistants. And one of the first things I remember is feeling absolutely repulsed when they were laughing and joking about a woman who they had done 9 abortions on.
Oh, my goodness.
And how irresponsible she was and, you know, stupid. And it just turned my stomach. I got a real quick view, just putting my ear over that conversation, to exactly how he felt about the unborn. This was just business as usual for most of them. And even the women nurses that were in there and their casual attitude towards the whole thing, it was just repulsive. I mean, it put a chill up my spine, like the very presence of evil was in that room. So very, very hard to get over that. And then, of course, over the years, we would have, you know, other family gatherings, Christmas and Easter and summer parties. But he was very hit and run in as far as relationship goes. It was like, you know, come at you and say something. And he had to be on top of the conversation all the time. He was very nervous. I would say misogynistic. He would buttonhole women in the corner about abortion, but he wouldn't talk with it about men. Men, he wouldn't discuss it. He was very, you know, he would talk about automobiles and, you know, science. And he's a very, very smart man. He had a degree in chemical engineering and a medical degree.
Wow.
And so he, you know, I think he used his intellect to keep people at an arm's length so they could never really get to know who George really was. Very controlling of the conversation. And when it started not going his way, in the 38 years that I was related to him, I probably had a total of 5 hours of conversation, you know, including phone calls where we'd, you know, he would call me once in a while to discuss a problem with a vehicle of his or whatever, seeing as I'm a mechanic. But then in the end, he would disagree with my opinion and end the call, and that was
the end of that.
So I could never be right. It was something to do with, you know, having control and,
sure,
and wanting to be smarter than you, and a sign of a man who had a very, very poor self-esteem in the long run, you know, only shored up by his intellect.
Right. You know? Now, as I understand it, he and his wife never had any children, right?
No, they had no children. Right? Matter of fact, in the 35 years they were married, I had never been to the house. For the first 5 years they were married, I lived 15 miles away, you know, and after that, just a 3-hour drive from them. But in 35 years, had never been invited to the house. Hmm. And when I was called on the 6th of September in 2019 to assist the cleanup effort after his death, because he was a hoarder and the house was such a mess, it was the first time I ever looked on that house, first time I ever saw it, first time I ever knew actually the street they lived on and where it was.
Wow.
So we never had gone for Christmas or Easter or any entertainment, no parties, nothing.
Wow. Was that when you learned of Dr. Klopfer's passing on the 6th? He actually passed on the 3rd of September, as I recall.
Well, I heard of his passing, but on the 6th was when my wife went to go help out at his home in Illinois. She got there and immediately said, "You have to come help out because this is too much and we don't know what to do."
Wow.
So we arrived to find a house filled from floor to ceiling, and it was a giant house, big 3.5-car garage and outbuildings. But there was really only 2 places or 3 you could sit more than one person in the whole house. And then you could stand up in the kitchen next to the stove if you wanted to with a couple people, but there was no place to sit more than one person on a chair anywhere.
How did his wife live all those years in those circumstances?
Well, it didn't start out that way. It was a, you know, a posh neighborhood with upper class neighborhood, but he had a habit of just neglecting everything. You know, everything was undone, you know, unpaid bills, start something and then not finish it. Constantly busy. Part of that was maybe that's how you're able to not stop and think about what you're doing if you're constantly busy. If there's no time for reflection, meditation, and
good point. Well, this is Kathy Humburger. You're listening to I Choose Life News and Views, and we're having a fascinating conversation with the brother-in-law of abortionist Ulrich Klopfer as we think about the events of a year ago and Dr. Klopfer's passing. And then could you help us understand, Mark, what it was like when you were standing in the garage the day that the gruesome discovery was made?
Well, we began to clear the clutter of the home and open up the garage door to find a wall of everything that he had saved, you know, every old box and old medical equipment, car parts, empty dog food containers, and he never discarded a container, regardless of what he bought or what it was for. So as we were digging through the second day, and it was the evening, I opened up a cardboard box and found some bags in there with liquid in it. And as I lifted the third bag out, I realized what I was looking at. I almost collapsed. It was beyond anything I ever thought. My son was with me, and he came and saw it, and he immediately wanted to leave and never come back.
And of course, what you were seeing were the remains of unborn boys and girls that had been aborted.
Yes, and what helped me identify that that's what it was at first, because it had deteriorated so badly from being there for so many years. I was able to feel a piece of cartilage or bone in one of the bags.
Oh, my.
I for sure knew what I was dealing with. So, you know, in my head goes all kinds of scenarios. What do we do? Couldn't we just push this to the back of the garage, which would have taken a couple of days to get back there, but and just forget about it until we have everything done and cleaned out and then call somebody? Who would we call? What would we do? Could we just bury these, you know, in the backyard? You know, and I thought to myself with my son, I said, we were not criminals before we came here. We have no criminal background, and I don't want one. So I got a hold of my wife, and she was aghast and immediately began to pray. And my sister-in-law was totally not aware that it was there. She was totally surprised. She had items that we found in the garage that she had gotten as wedding gifts 35 years earlier and had been looking for the last 35 years. So not only did she not know about what was in there, she didn't even know. I mean, there was only a short path to even be able to pass by anything in the garage to get into the house through the back way. So, but she was aghast, but it was more, I mean, I think there was some anger that came to her, but there was a lot of just bewilderment. Now, she knew what he did. I mean, she knew what his business was. I know she didn't want anything to do with his business. But she became a believer, and I think wanted to honor the commitment she made, you know, of her covenant with him in marriage, and was able to draw on her faith to be able to even stay with the man. So anyways, we sat and discussed it, and then happened to have an attorney that she knew that was close by and consulted him, and he said we need to get some other attorneys involved that were more into what kind of situation we were in here. And we got other attorneys and we sat down and talked, and they said, this is how we're going to have to handle it. And then the attorneys are the ones that disclosed it to the Will County authorities. And so immediately began, you know, a giant media circus. And I can tell you, I don't think that the Super Bowl gets much more attention than this. Because,
yeah, I remember.
Which is to me somewhat hypocritical, because why? Why this happens on a daily basis in this country, 2,000 abortions. And then you find 2,000 in a garage, it's a big deal.
Right.
All of a sudden, the news media is all over it. Well, where are you every day when this is happening?
Right.
You know?
And then I think about that time, Attorney General Curtis Hill from Indiana got involved and connected with the Will County authorities.
Yes, he did. All the law enforcement was great, especially the Indiana people. I see that the Indiana people were very respectful of the pro-life position. Saw them as unborn, didn't see them as fetal tissue or, you know, samples or so. That was very respectful and very good in the way it should be. But I knew that my sister-in-law knew nothing about this. She had no idea that he had a commercial building he was doing abortions in Fort Wayne. Mm. That's how secret he even kept it from his own wife. So there was no hiding. But both sides of the fence here on this issue kind of lit up, and a lot of it was needed a lot of speculation at first on both sides. Obviously, the pro-abortion people are going to try and minimize everything they can about it, you know, right. And say, hey, wait a minute, this is legal, and they try to quell the whole thing. But on the other side of things, the pro-life movement sometimes, I think, has to be very careful not to speculate.
Right.
You know, let's get the facts, let's find out what's going on, let's treat, just like you said early on in this discussion, everybody with dignity. So my job, I thought, was, first of all, to kind of protect my sister-in-law and her reputation. And also, she was a little bit afraid of reprisal from the pro-life community in some ways. So we were guarded at the house 24-7 for 2 weeks by the Will County Sheriff. And fortunately, nothing happened. I didn't think it would, because basically the war was over. It started quite a search. I mean, the following Monday after the discovery, the Will County law enforcement basically sent 50 people from crime scene investigation and SWAT to come out and go through the house and everything they could find there at that location to see if there was any more. And fortunately, it didn't turn up anything else. And then also 3 days later, 2 days later, a joint effort by Indiana law enforcement to go to all of the other properties that he owned in Indiana and search them. And obviously his clinics in Gary and in Fort Wayne and in South Bend and whatever other properties he had. And fortunately, you know, didn't turn up anything there. And that was quite a discovery to me, to be able to go with and assist Aaron, the assistant attorney general, and side by side in opening up, you know, everything that we could find that he owned and trying to see what was there and what was going on. It was quite extensive.
What did the interior of the buildings look like?
In Gary, the operations were done in the basement. The basement was so hideous. Of course, it had been shut down for a while, but it was so hideous that the assistant attorney general went down the stairs and said, don't go down there. It was a dungeon. My heart broke for the fact that I could picture a woman going into this basement to have this surgery. My son told me at that point, he said, Dad, I wouldn't even have a tattoo done in this building, let alone something like that.
Wow.
He said, I wouldn't have my ears pierced here. It was that unsanitary and that medical equipment strewn everywhere and papers everywhere and every corner, something was stuffed in. And some of the equipment that we found for abortions, you know, were not medical grade. It regularly would flood, though, and he would have to go and mitigate that and then get it back to where he could continue to work. So, you know, I mean, you got all that left over. It was not pretty. You know, same thing in Fort Wayne. There was times when it would flood and you'd have to deal with that. You know, the Fort Wayne building represented somewhat of a medical facility. But the more I think about it, I am somewhat aghast that it is legal to operate a medical facility that is not regulated or inspected at least as much as you would expect a hospital or a dentist's office even.
And the interesting thing, Mark, is that abortion facilities are licensed in the state of Indiana and they are inspected, and yet this happened.
Some of these are operated by collectives. He was a member of several abortion collectives where you had, you know, half a dozen to a dozen abortion doctors around the country who would jointly own facilities or jointly form a practice so that when litigation would come against them for malpractice or whatever, it would become so complicated because there would be so many jurisdictions involved that it would get mired down and very difficult to prosecute or pursue.
Right. Well, there were no remains found in any of the facilities, but there were more located, right?
Yeah. He collected old cars. So we knew that. We didn't always know the location, but because he saved everything, we were able to find, you know, rental deposits or receipts for payment to where storage was. And one of them was not in Will County, so it didn't get investigated right away. It was in Cook County, south side of Chicago. So I had to get back to work after 6 weeks of tackling this. So I told my son, you better go and take a look at those cars because the rent is due and we just want to dispose of them. They were basically scrap. And so he went there and I was working and he was texting me and showing me pictures of these things. And I was like, oh, that's nice. You know, maybe we can salvage that. Maybe we can do that. But then a half hour later, I didn't check my text. I suddenly got a text that said, bad news. And we had keys that we were trying to match up with the vehicle so we could get them moved out of there. And the second vehicle, he looked in the trunk, he found deteriorated cardboard boxes and bags and
more babies.
And he knew immediately when he saw it, he knew that that's what he had found. There was 160 more babies in the trunk. So finally, I got a hold of him 2 hours later. He just said, what do I do? And I said, we got to do what we do. We always do. We call the law enforcement and the authorities. So he did that, and then that gruesome discovery came to light, and Will County Sheriff got involved again. And so then became more thorough searching. Both Indiana and Illinois, we got more involved and ended up getting more intense on some of the researching some of the places and looking at more in depth at where we could find things. And unfortunately, nothing else was ever found. We spent weeks opening boxes after that. And Every time we would run into a box that looked like or was close to, or maybe we found a box that had an ice pack in it or something like that, a little bit of weight and a little bit of liquid. And my son went back right off because of the memories.
Are you confident now that there are no more babies anywhere to be found from Ulrich Klopfer?
We have searched high and low, purchased a metal detector and dug up things and overturned things. And we have parsed through walls and heat ducts and attics and under floorboards in buildings. And we have found nothing.
Well, thank you for sticking with it and making certain that all of these babies' bodies were treated respectfully. And I'm sure you wanted to make certain if there were any more that they were treated in the same respectful way. This has gone on now for about a year. How has this impacted you? This must be awful to live with.
Well, it's exhausting. It's hard to even go about a normal day without thinking about it. But you know, it's motivated me to action more than just talk. And it's renewed my zeal, whatever chance I get, whatever way God brings me, to explain to folks, because now I have firsthand, I mean, I've seen all the medical instruments used. I've seen all the gruesomeness of this procedure and where and how it's done. I think the biggest problem we have is even for people who are very pro-life, they still don't have a super grasp on the reality of this. I mean, I did somewhat, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, I've seen, I've looked at, you know, YouTube videos and I can understand. And I mean, much as I don't want to watch that stuff because I mean, I think in some ways we kind of duck our head. Those that are pro-life are, I'm averse to watching a baby be killed on on a YouTube video or something. I don't want to see that. But we need to know that this is instruments of death. This is the darkest side of humanity that is out there. You know, ultimately, this is not a war against flesh and blood. Evenly, this is a spiritual war that we are in, and it is basically because the enemy of our souls hates humanity, hates people, the apple of God's eye, and wants to do everything he can do to murder, kill, and destroy us. That's the root right there. And everything else that comes out of that is what happens when we fight this fight. I have felt a lot of oppression. It's been a struggle sometimes in dealing with, you know, my own relationships with my family and my wife because of what we've seen and what's happened. I question over and over again why I didn't get involved earlier, but this man just, I hate to say it, but he just turned my stomach so bad that I didn't want contact with him. I didn't want contact. My children have contact with him, and every time I saw him interact with children, I could tell he was a very wounded man. I mean, that had in his childhood been arrested by this involvement that he had in World War II, where he was so young when the bombing of Dresden happened.
Right. And he's told that story over and over again to those of us who have come to know him over the years. How can we pray for you, Mark, and your family and Mrs. Klopfer?
Pray that we'll be able to first of all, find people who are interested, pro-life centers. I would like that we have some medical equipment that I would like to see that goes to a pro-life cause and have to be distinctly pro-life. And then that we'd be able to sell off whatever remaining assets we have here and use the money for the right purpose and be done with this, you know, once and for all. And then be able to use it as a way to, you know, reinforce the message that like all life is sacred and hopefully we've learned that this does happen and this is how it really is. It's ugly. George was not a man who kept trophies. I mean, that's a myth I had to dispel right away. I thought there was a lot of speculation that what was he doing? Was there a museum? No. He was a man who was cheap. They shut down the pathology labs that he would send, you know, these babies to. Everyone was required to be a pathology report on each abortion that he did and have to come back to make sure that it was complete or if there was any other issues. And he in the meantime, I think when one of the labs was shut down, just started storing it. And then one day realized I've got all this here I can't keep here, you know, and I got to move it and temporarily put it in his garage. And then, of course, being a hoarder and a procrastinator and accumulator, that's where it ended up. And that's where it stayed for all those years. So, yeah, it was really horrible. The fact that we had, you know, my first involvement and my first visit to, you know, his home turns out like this. In some ways, it's brought us together as a family because we look at it and we've gone through a war together in a way, like the, you know, post-war buddies kind of syndrome where it's, oh my goodness, I can't believe we went through this. Can you believe that? I'm really glad to say that in my family that, you know, we all see it the same way as horror. So there's still some coming to grips with it, I think, maybe on the, you know, on the part of some family members where they still almost, I don't want to even talk or think about this right now. It's still being processed. So pray for that. Pray that we have peace of mind and peace from God, and that the enemy would not be able to pry us apart, you know, due to our difficulties or, you know, I mean, there's been depression over it. There's been nightmares. There's been, you know, and just a sadness that in our country, in the United States, that this can actually happen. It's so unnerving. It's like, it makes me feel a little bit unsure about where we are as a country sometimes, or as a people, as a human race. That comment that Aldrich made in Mark Archer's film there, where he said, you know, it's what human beings will do to each other. Well, that's great as long as you see them as human beings. Unfortunately, some people don't see it that way. So just pray for a steadiness and a reassurance from God that we can get past this and move on and go back to a normal life. Well, it's taken a year out of my life, I can tell you that. I haven't been able to think about much else.
Right. Well, it certainly sounds as if the Lord was preparing you all those years ago, Mark, for the task that he had for you. And had you not been there and had you not been willing to speak out, all of this would still be a secret. And the horror that you saw firsthand would not have been shared with those of us who need to be reminded and need to hear the truth about this awful scourge that's on our country called abortion. We certainly appreciate your willingness to be transparent. I know this has been a sensitive conversation for you, Mark, and I just thank the Lord that he has built a relationship between the two of us, that we are friends, and that we could have this conversation. So we will certainly be praying for peace for you and your family as you continue to heal from this and move on. But you have certainly contributed a great deal to our continuing fight against abortion.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to ichooselife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.